I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Before we turn to your essential political analysis for this week, I want to tell you about our wonderful partners at The Resident, where all rooms are designed to combine pure comfort with quintessential British style and design. Whether you're escaping to London for a romantic break or visiting the city with friends and family, there's no better place to stay in the heart of the neighbourhood. Without The Resident, you might not get to experience London, and without The Resident, we wouldn't be here on Whitehall Sources. Whitehall Sources, your essential politics podcast, is brought to you in association with The Resident. Welcome to Whitehall Sources. I'm Callum MacDonald. We're recording on Thursday, the 25th of April. And here's Kirsty Buchanan, former special advisor to Theresa May when she was Prime Minister. Hello, Kirsty.
Good evening. I'm speaking to you from my bed.
Yeah, I see that. You're very relaxed, very chilled. We're going for a sort of, you know, Kirsty Buchanan after dark.
Yeah. Well, do you know why I've really taken to my bed? Because obviously I had an operation a couple of weeks ago. So yeah. I'm not exactly at full strength, but I decided to do the full kind of SW1 Westminster party bubble circuit for the last couple of days. And I can't schmooze and booze like I used to. So I've taken to my bed.
Where were you last night?
Last night, I was at the book launch of the brilliant, if slightly overdue in its delivery, new book by Tim Shipman, doyen political writer of this parish, called No Way Out. Now, obviously, this is about the Theresa May Brexit battle years, so it should probably come with a trigger warning for me and everybody else that you know can remember those years at first hand. But like, it was hosted by Policy Exchange in like the smallest room I think that you could, and I'm just like, it's Tim Shipman's yeah. Long-awaited brilliant book that everyone has been, you know, genuinely waiting to get their hands on. Free bar courtesy of lovely Diageo. And
thank you, Diageo.
And Policy Exchange has seemingly put us in a quite large cupboard. I mean, it was absolutely boiling. And I mean boiling.
Oh, no.
So I think at one point, my ankles were getting prickly heat. It was so hot in it. But lots of old friends there, lots of people I haven't seen for a while, lots and lots of gossip, of which we can talk about some of it, and a very, very funny speech by Tim about why we've all ended up waiting many years for the third tome. So people will remember, obviously, the first book charted the referendum and the run-up to the referendum and the loss of that. The second one was the kind of, should we loosely kind of say that the Nick and Fee years at number 10 and how Theresa May decided to try and strengthen the hand of the government by going in that disastrous 2017 general election.
So those were chiefs of staff, Nick and Fee.
I beg your pardon. Like, Nick and Fee, like I know them really well. Yeah. So Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, who were the former chiefs of staff of Theresa May, she went for the 2017 general election to strengthen the negotiating hand of government for Brexit. And obviously the rest, as they say, is history on that. And then this is the third tome, which is, you know, kind of picks up where the kind of end of 2017 left off, if you like. And funnily enough, I had a little bet with myself about what would be the opening page, the opening, you know, way into this massive tome for
the
Tim.
Scene setter. Yeah.
And I know how much Tim loves a bit of colour. And I thought, I bet you he's done that scene at the, I think it was 2018, 2017 Christmas party at number 10. So, you know, this is all true. You know, there was a staff Christmas party at number 10. So there's people upstairs, going downstairs, drunk, stumbling around with cans in their hands. There's the karaoke bar going on upstairs. And downstairs in a room is Theresa May and Gavin Barwell talking to Arlene Foster and telling Arlene Foster, who is in a confidence DUP or a confidence supply agreement with the government at the time, that she was going to take the plane out to Brussels and agree that sufficient progress had been made for them to talk about the future arrangements. It was a big moment for Brexit. And we were all in another room listening into the call and holding our breath. And it was a big gamble for her because effectively, didn't bounce Arlene, but she said, look, I've got to take a decision in the interest of what I believe to be best for the UK as a whole. And that's what I'm going to do. And Arlene said, well, you know, I'll have to get back to you, etc. And then upstairs on the karaoke and Come On Eileen came on and everyone started singing, Come On Arlene, you know, all totally true. We all slept there that night. I can tell you that sleeping on the floor at number 10 is both cold and uncomfortable. And then it led to that 4 a.m. flight, I think it was, to Brussels, that beautiful, it's my favourite picture of the Theresa May years, which is getting on the plane, the black and white shot. And there's just her and her aide, Tricky, we used to call him, Richard N. Jackson, climbing up the steps to go to Brussels to declare that we had enough progress had been made to move forward to discussing the future arrangement. And then it slightly, that was the high water mark. And then everything slightly unraveled after that for the next 2 years, very, very slowly. But that was how he led it on the book. And I'm only about 50 pages in, but, you know, not for nothing is Tim, you know, known as one of the kind of best writers of his generation. The amount of complexity and depth he can get into a page and still make it, you know, just page-turningly good is just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm going to be doing this weekend.
Well, that sounds great. Our copy's arrived. It's through there, sitting in the bedroom right now, actually. I'm looking forward to it. Should I expect a mention of you in the book, Kirsty?
You should. So as Tim was signing my inscription, he looked at me and he said, you're in the book, by the way. And I said, and you're telling me this now, Tim? And he's like, oh, it's fine.
I thought you were supposed to be told in advance.
He said, oh, it's fine, you're fine. And I'm like, So I spent the rest of this kind of party talking to people, wanting to pick up my book and run to the toilet to check if there was an index to see how, quote unquote, fine I was. And then I just thought, you know what? It doesn't matter, does it? You know? I'm sure it will be fine.
Everything you say is always sensible and wise.
Thank you.
So,
and I did get a lovely inscription from him on my book, so that was nice.
Good.
Got one for my father, my pops, who loves Tim Shipman's work.
Lovely.
So it was a very good evening. Picked up quite a lot of gossip, of which we can talk about too.
Brill. Well, we'll do some gossiping. And by the way, just as a note, listeners, when we say that we bring you inside politics, you can't get much more inside politics than that. Sleeping on the floor of number 10, being in Tim Shipman's new book, being at the launch of Tim Shipman's new book, and picking up lots of gossip along the way, which we love to hear. Right, good. Lots to talk about. We'll come back to the gossip in a mo. I want to start, though, with the Bute House Agreement. This is the agreement that had the SNP and the Scottish Greens in coalition. Until today, Humza Yousaf has blown it up. He's thrown it in the bin. And I've been on and off Times Radio all day talking about it. So it's very in my mind, Kirsty, as to what's been going on and as to what happens next. I think where we start with this is possibly Humza Yousaf jumping before he was pushed, which is a phrase we'll probably come back to in this conversation.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, you know, I've not been able to move without you on my airwaves today. I've been very busy chap. And from what I can glean from this is exactly what's happened, basically. The Greens had a tizzy fit because the SNP have spectacularly missed their climate change targets, by about as much as it's possible for something to be missed. And they were going to consider, you know, whether they wanted to, continue to effectively prop up the SNP government, which I think without them is a minority.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
And so basically the First Minister went, well, I'm going to beat you to the punch and tear up the agreement first, which...
Yeah, which I think is an interesting one.
Which he tried to present as a position of strength, but I'm confused.
Yeah. So I think there is confusion. So that's exactly right. So basically with Humza Yousaf, there's an argument that his hand was forced because the Scottish Greens wanted to hold this emergency general meeting. I think the plan had been towards the end of next month. Ironically, they were going to announce the exact date of that today before all of this went down the plug hole. And so the question was whether Humza Yousaf would get there first. Who was going to dump who first? And I clocked this quote in the Daily Record, citing one of the most senior SNP figures. Make of that what you will. Here's the quote. Were they expecting the governing party to let them dominate the airwaves for a month and make endless demands? Shut up and sit down. Who do they think they are? So I think there was a bit of political calculation here in that Humza Yousaf didn't want the Scottish Greens to be making demands, saying, here's how this is going to work. The emergency general meeting was to get a vote in of all the members, basically a referendum on should they stay in the Bute House agreement or not. And I think the expectation was that members probably would have said, get out of it. So yes, it was about Humza Yousaf trying to reframe that. Now, as the day has gone on, it's become clear that he may have slightly shot himself in the foot, because the breakup, as it were, between the SNP and the Greens has been vicious. I mean, the statement from the Greens was absolutely brutal, saying that Humza Yousaf's, you know, you can't trust him in politics, he's betrayed a generation. You know, they properly went in. Then the Scottish Conservatives said they were lodging a motion of no confidence in Humza Yousaf, which then all the opposition parties have said, we're backing that, we're going to sign that. So that will go to a vote for sure. The Greens piled in saying, we're going to back it, we're voting no confidence in Humza Yousaf. And so now we're in the position, as Thursday ends, where Ash Regan, who ran against Humza Yousaf for the SNP leadership a year ago, then defected to join Alex Salmond's Alibi party, now will hold the casting vote in the vote of no confidence in the First Minister when it comes probably next week.
And so to confirm the maths of that then, what is the specific split? Is it literally she's the one that will tip him into majority and save his bacon, as it were?
So it's like this. So the SNP have 63 MSPs. So then when we add up the Tories on 31... Labour on 22, the Lib Dems on 4, and the Greens on 7, and then Alba on 1, that's the entirety of the opposition, that's 65. So if Ash Regan goes for it, then they end up in a 64-64. Have I done the maths right on that? Check my maths. I think I've been saying it all day. But yes, basically, they would have 65, so 64, yeah, it'd be 64, 64. And so they would be, in the event of a 64, 64, it's hey-ho status quo. The presiding officer says, we keep things as they are. But I would argue, and without wishing to trigger you further, you're probably more familiar with the ins and outs of confident votes than I am, but I would argue that the act of the vote of no confidence in itself is a risk. If he concedes to Ash Regan's demands, what does that say about his ability to govern and his ability to lead? It feels like it might be a bit of a lose-lose, actually, for Humza Yousaf at this point.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Did they not kind of map this out and gameplay how this might fold out before he, you know, broke up their relationship, as it were? Because I mean, the reason I struggled with it in this morning was because he tried to frame it as a sort of, this shows what a kind of strong leader I am. And then obviously the vote of no confidence issue raised really quickly. Did no one see this coming?
Well, and you know, one of the other things, Kirsty, is to do it today, which is the day of First Minister's questions. So he did his, it was all sort of leaking and announcing first thing this morning. Then he had his press conference, what, around 10 a.m. And then it's First Minister's questions in the chamber at Holyrood at midday, which obviously then this dominated, gives Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader, the chance to say, I'm lodging this motion of no confidence. So strategically, you could have left it till the afternoon and then gone away for the weekend and given everyone a breather. You know, even that is kind of a basic strategy point.
Yeah, let's set myself up as a sitting duck and provide lots of beautiful clips for the evening broadcast news.
Exactly.
Of that's Douglas exactly Ross going, it. I'm going to call a vote of no confidence. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm just
and then just
the
one
news.
By one. Exactly. One by one, the other leaders of opposition parties stand up and back it, basically. So there is that. And then I think if you take it all the way back to square one, critics of Humza Yousaf's leadership would say the time to sink the Bute House agreement would have been when he took over, because at that point you're almost empowered, you're almost encouraged to say, here's what I'm keeping, here's what I'm binning. But because he was Nicola Sturgeon's continuity candidate and the deal was hers to begin with, in the interest of having an independent majority at Holyrood, he stuck with it. So if he'd binned it a year ago, would he be here now? Probably not.
Is this just his, I mean, one of the things that Tim Shipp was saying last night about what he's learned about politics over the last 7 odd years is that a lot of people that are very senior in politics are not very good at politics. Mm-hmm. Is it that he's not very good and his aides aren't very good, or is it that he tends to overrule them? What is the feeling about how they've got themselves in this pickle? Why did nobody game plan this at the top and see this coming? And it's not a, it doesn't feel like a wise after the event kind of thing. It seems a pretty likely reaction if you're about to try and leave your ex-partner with egg on their face, that they're not going to take that kindly, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's all a bit bitter. I think the question on whether he is good at politics is pertinent. Everyone you speak to that knows him would say he's a really nice person, he's good company, you know, he's quite funny, all of these sorts of things, but doesn't necessarily have the instinct of a politician. And then the question on his aides, he's actually surrounded by some quite experienced people who have worked with Salmond and Sturgeon and others. But the Sunday Times, a couple of months ago, ran a piece that said those aides were basically being frozen out and that Humza Yousaf was not paying any attention to them and actually was paying a lot more attention to his wife. And it was kind of becoming a bit of those two running the show. And the aides were sort of offering advice and offering counsel and offering guidance, and none of that was really getting through. So it's interesting that you say that, because that story ran, it was at least a couple of months ago now. And it would seem that if he, well, I don't know, perhaps, but you can assume that if he had paid a bit more attention, perhaps, to the advice he was getting, would he have ended up in this situation now? And I think the answer to that would probably be no. It's all against the backdrop also of the general election. I mean, it's hilarious, really. It's kind of bonkers to think there could be a Scottish election, theoretically, before a general election now, when in theory it should be 2 years away in 2026. But it's just, I find today intriguing because it's spiraled off in so many different directions.
And this is the thing, you're right about, you know, a vote of no confidence. You know, we had one, obviously, when I was at number 10 with Teresa and she won it. So here's the interesting thing. A, even if he wins it, he's not going to win it comfortably.
No.
He's going to win it by skin of his teeth territory.
Literally, yeah, knife edge stuff.
Yeah. And even if you win it, quote unquote, relatively comfortably, in effect, the act of it takes on a momentum of its own. You know, it is very, you are hold below the waterline from the minute that that goes in and that, you know, and that becomes the issue. So, it feels to me almost like, you know, he's overshot his hand, and he might just have brought the whole thing crashing down because he doesn't seem to be that great at politics and, you know,
I think that's
playing the game.
Yeah. And that's it. Exactly. Exactly it. I think part of the other, just a concluding thought, and I'm borrowing this from Jeff Aberdeen, with whom I do the Hollywood Sources podcast, along with Andy McKeever, who used to work for the Scottish Tories. But Jeff was Alex Salmond's chief of staff when he was first minister. And he has said from the word go, Hamza has missed out big time because he didn't set a clear vision of what he wanted to do. And he didn't sort of set out that mission statement to which everything else then sort of comes back to, that center of gravity around which everything else revolves. He hasn't done that. And so he has found himself being blown around in the wind and never really kind of making good decisions because what does he stand for? What's his vision? What does he want to achieve? And perhaps this is just the culmination of that, that without his own direction, he has been buffeted by the Scottish Greens to the point now where it could be the ultimate demise of Hamza Yousaf as First Minister.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, I've always said if nature abhors a vacuum, then politics abhors one even more. You know, if you don't create a narrative and a story and a vision, then people will fill in the lines for you. And that will never be in a helpful way. So, you know, and I was talking about this last night with someone at the party at the book launch. You know, and for me, you know I've wanged on about this a million times in this podcast, but my sliding doors moment for Rishi Sunak was last October at conference speech when he had that opportunity to set out the vision thing. So we'd had first year, you know, man stabilises ship after, you know, Liz Truss has run it aground and backed it up off the ground and run it aground again and smashed up the hull and broken all the sails and everything, right? So he's fixed the ship and set it back and stabilised it. Fine. We'd all taken that as being the first part one of Rishi Sunak. But what was part two? Once you've got the ship stabilised, what is the direction that you are setting it for sailing to? And that's what we never got. We got some weird stuff about baccalaureates and banning smoking and banning HS2. And that was it. You know, and that was the sliding door. Now, it's a counterfactual that I can never prove. But you've got to be able to tell people a story of, you know, what it is that you're there for. Why are you there? And if you can't tell me, then how am I supposed to buy into it if I don't know what I'm supposed to be buying into? You know, we're talking about one person with, you know, no real kind of good political gut instinct. And yeah, and then another at number two.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Let me tell you about the resident hotel where I just stayed. That's right, I have been to the resident in Liverpool for a lovely, lovely stay. I have to be honest, it was wonderful. And I'm not just saying that. I promise you it was great. The warmest of welcome from the lovely reception team, including a lovely welcome card signed by Megan and the resident team. We were offered a map. We were offered guidance on where to go for food and for drinks. The location was great. We had several activities in Liverpool. We had a friend's birthday dinner. Then we were bowling, we were doing all of that stuff, and all of it was within a 10-minute walk of where the hotel was, which was perfect. Not only that, we had guidance on the best local restaurants and bars where we could also get discounts as a result of staying at the resident. The little kitchen in the hotel room was very, very helpful for coffee drinkers. Unbelievably, I'm not one. There's a little coffee machine right there as well. Do you know what was lovely as well? City centre location. Double glazing. There was the outdoor window, then an indoor window. No noise. I slept like an actual log. Beautiful room, very spacious, well equipped, lovely hotel, lovely staff, lovely location. Take this as a personal endorsement. I've been there, done that, and you should do the same. Stay at the resident. Shall we talk more about Rishi Sunak, actually? Because he's been, I would argue, Kirsty, defining the message a bit this week, actually. Setting the news agenda in a way that has perhaps been quite positive as far as he is concerned. So we had the big announcement on defence spending, and that's going to come into line with 2.5% of GDP over the next few years. He's been doing his tour around Europe. He's been in Poland and in Germany, trying to sort of build up this feeling of support from other European countries for contributions to NATO in the interest of the security of us all. Would you agree that Rishi Sunak has been kind of setting the message this week?
Rishi unleashed. Yes. It's almost like
let Rishi be Rishi.
It's almost like you've got a Conservative Prime Minister at number 10, isn't it? It's quite true. Last week he was talking about welfare reform, and this week he's going on about defence and backing our troops and standing up for cupcakes and crumbly candy bars and liberal democracy and all that stuff. Yeah, look, I think this is interesting. And frustrating, perhaps, all at the same time, because I think off the back of a round of by-election defeats that were coming in the summer of last year, there's been so many, I can't remember exactly which ones they were. It might have been even the Uxbridge and the other two. Someone at number 10 briefed in to the Sunday Times, I presume because they thought it might lead to a slightly wobbly vote, a potential vote of no confidence, that, you know, he'd stabilised the ship and thereafter we were going to see a much more muscular Rishi Sunak prepared to take the fight to, you know, do you remember this?
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, fine. Here's the second part of the Rishi Sunak plan, one stabilised, two set, you know, direction. And it never really happened. Instead, we got, like I say, weird baccalaureate and smoking bans. But that, what we've seen the last week or so, I was talking to someone from number 10 the other day and I said, look, this is what you promised kind of last summer. And this actually feels good and it feels positive. And I was thinking about it, you know, and we were obviously talking about it quite a lot last night as well. And everyone was sort of saying, great, brackets, too little, too late. And I wonder whether, you know, I've been reading a lot about psychology recently, you know, and it just feels a little bit like a man who's been slightly liberated. And one of the main reasons I can think of for liberation is he can feel the end is nigh.
Right.
And actually, you think, do you know what? You know, this isn't, you know, I've tried to, you know, turn things around, to narrow the polls. It's not happening, you know. And so, by gosh, no matter how long I've got left here, I'm going to say what I want, do what I want. And actually, that's why you've got this kind of Rishi Unleashed thing. So freed up from the constraints a bit of being worried about how people might react to stuff, you've actually got a much more, you know, authentic politician who sounds and feels a lot more like, you know, you'd expect a conservative prime minister to sound and to feel. So actually, yeah, I think he's had a good week, but I think the psychology that sits underneath it is particularly fascinating. And here is another little sort of gem. Like I say, I spent the last 2 days doing the whole SW1 kind of circuit.
Love it.
Absolutely everybody I have spoken to, and I do mean everybody, you know, very senior people in politics, in journalism, everybody thinks that after the May elections, regardless almost of the result, but especially if Andy Street loses the mayoral contest in Birmingham and Ben Houchen, both Conservatives obviously, Ben Houchen loses that mayoral contest in Teesside, that rump of political pygmies that everyone has spent the last few weeks saying, be quiet, you know, unite, take the fight to Labour, they will use that as the excuse to force a vote of no confidence. And similarly, as we were talking about in Holyrood, Rishi will win that, but it will leave him so fatally damaged as to destroy any other chance that the Conservatives had of closing that poll gap in the run-up to what originally and has always been designed by Number 10 to be a late autumn, sort of October, November general election. And here's the other thing. Number 10 has briefed out in the past that if that happens and if they come for them, he may trigger a July election instead. Now that, I presume, is designed to frighten people into not, you know, pulling the trigger. But this sort of stuff takes on its own momentum, you know, and once you've unleashed that beast, you know, as the First Minister in Scotland is currently finding out, you know, politics starts to take, you know, it takes on its own momentum. So it will be fascinating to see. We might actually have two votes of no confidence in quick succession.
Wow.
Which might both be won, but weirdly might both ultimately end up in a general election happening sooner rather than later in both cases, in any event.
This summer could be totally crazy. And by the way, some top goss from Kirsty Buchanan there, sort of piecing all of those things together. Just to say, I'm not certain what the rules are when it comes to podcasts and elections, but I'm aware that on the radio, our obligations are when we mention one candidate in a race, we have to mention all of them. So I'm going to do that with the mayors that we just mentioned. For Mayor of Tees Valley, you've got Ben Houchen for the Conservative and Unionist Party, Chris McEwen for the Labour and Cooperative Party, and Simon Thorley for the Liberal Democrats. And in the race to be Mayor of the West Midlands, Siobhan Harper-Noons from the Green Party, Richard Parker from the Labour and Cooperative Party, Andy Street from the Conservative and Unionist Party, Sonny Virk for the Liberal Democrats, Elaine Ruth Williams from Reform UK, and Ahmed Yacoub, who is an independent candidate. Don't know if you need to do that on podcast, but hey, we've done it anyway.
And I'm sorry, if I realised it's going to force you to do all of that nonsense, I would have not mentioned them by now. And I would have just said... I would have just said Chappies in Birmingham and Tees Valley. I apologise for that. But nevertheless, that's where they're at, I think. And I could not find a single person that doesn't think that a vote of no confidence will come straight after the May elections.
Well, that is fascinating. And the May elections, and there is a by-election, there's a parliamentary by-election as well, isn't there? So that is all happening a week today, actually, the 2nd of May, or when those elections are happening. And for months, we've been kind of talking about them as the next flashpoint for Rishi Sunak. And the gossip that you've been picking up in your mingle schmooze fests is that, yes, it's going to be quite the flashpoint, actually.
You know, and the reality is, whilst it doesn't suit some leadership contenders, like, you know, Kemi Badenoch, for argument's sake, the two that it does suit, obviously, are Penny Mordaunt and Grant Shapps, both of whom are likely to lose their seats in a general election.
Yeah.
So for both of them, it's a kind of now or never. They either kind of go for the leadership now, or they're far more likely to be out of Parliament than not because of the polls, if the polls don't shift. Right. So it's not, you know, so there are willing leadership rivals who are prepared to, you know, to go for it now, because if they don't go for it now, they'll have lost their shot.
Well, you heard it here first. Thanks, Kirsty. This is Whitehall Sources bringing you inside politics, and that is one of the reasons why we say that. Right, the final thing we want to talk about tonight is rail nationalisation. So this is Labour's big announcement from today, that they want to re-nationalise the railways. What would it mean for commuters, I hear you ask? Well, they say there will be improvements on sort of value for money, basically, for passengers, savings for the public purse as well. Let me read you this from The Times. The party claims its reforms would make ticketing simpler and ultimately cheaper by simplifying the vast range of different ticket types and fares and discounts that currently exist. It's going to pledge to introduce a best price ticket guarantee for passengers, so that wherever a ticket's bought, it's always the cheapest fare available for the journey. That's not always the case right now. They say that renationalising train operating companies and merging them with the body that manages the rail network will create a unified system and will ensure that the services promised to passengers are delivered, thereby reducing delays. They want to call it Great British Railways, by the way, just as a note. The other thing, and actually listen up, is that they want to reduce overcrowding and introduce adequate Wi-Fi. Now, I'm not sure what adequate Wi-Fi means, because for me, I need super fast speeds. I need no interruption to my connection. I think I'm looking for something better than adequate. However, that's what they're saying. And so, yeah, savings for the public, et cetera, as well. It's interesting, Kirsty. In his leadership campaign in 2020, Starmer did promise to bring rail back into public ownership, along with, actually, the Postal Service, water and energy. But he did retreat from that stance, saying that buying out private owners was not a good use of public money. And so basically this idea is that they would bring railways back into public ownership as contracts expire, but there's no promise to buy out privately run utilities and other sectors. So there's an interesting evolution of Keir Starmer's thinking.
Evolution is a very kind word.
I knew you would say that.
Some might call it, you know, a massive U-turn on the 2019 manifesto, and might suggest that Starmer is inclined to say one thing to get elected and do something else once he's been elected. Some might say that. And look, you know, I have no problem with them, you know, ditching some of the crazier parts of Jeremy Corbyn's 2019 manifesto. Look, a whole bunch of things about this. One, nationalising railways has remained for quite a long time insanely popular with the public. And I mean, right across the piece, right? I don't just mean Labour voters. I think everyone can agree in the great big panoply of privatised utilities and privatised services that have not worked, how Thatcher envisaged franchising the railways has got to be number one, and I'd like to say many things right here, right now, but I will not, except to say I cannot think of a single other service where I'm required to pay that much money for such an appalling level of service, all delivered with some of the most sour-faced bloody people I've ever met in my life. Anyway,
back on track, haha.
I digress. So you know, a lot of it's kind of bring it on. Weirdly, it's kind of a odd combo of, in part, Labour's 2019 manifesto, but also Grant Shapps' Williams Review. So Grant Shapps and, I forgot his first name, but this chap called Williams did this big review of the rail network. Great British Railways is ostensibly their body, and it's to create a kind of overarching oversight body for the whole of the network and bring some sense and sanity into the issue.
It was Keith Williams was his name, the independent chair of the review.
Keith Williams. Yeah. Apologies, Keith Williams. And so actually quite a lot of this is sort of a weird combination of, you know, conservative thinking and Corbynista hangover. Having said all that, look, there's nothing wrong with it. They're doing it slowly rather than putting a massive charge onto the balance sheets by saying, right, we'll just buy up all the franchises now, so that when those franchises come up, they will simply revert to public ownership. if they are post-2019 and won't come up in the next 5 years, there are break clauses in any contracts, and Labour will use those break clauses to terminate the contracts. Interestingly, Labour has said that they will retain the open access services that run on the line. What are open access services? I hear you cry, Karen.
What are open access services, Kirsty?
Thank you. Can't get the staff. So open access, so say for argument, so you have a line and it has a franchise holder on it. So we're called, here is a line and it's run by Callum Enterprises. There are bits of time on that line where that line isn't being used by Callum Enterprises. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done is leased that time to Kirsty Enterprises. So when you're not running trains, Kirsty Enterprises can run trains on that line. And what actually you've found with those, some of those open access, like Hull Trains, for argument's sake, is they're actually really good at customer service. You know, the tickets are fair and simple and relatively cheap, and they're quite popular. So it's interesting that they're keeping that piece of the puzzle. It's also interesting that they're not taking the stock back into ownership. The stock will be held and leased back to Great British Railways, which stop short of the full kind of nationalisation that a lot on the left would like. So that's the kind of interesting politics end of it. The retail end of it, the consumer end of it, if I had a pound for every time I had heard a politician tell me that they were going to bring in simpler fares or tap-in, tap-out fares or automatic, you know, discounts when your train's been delayed and all of the kind of, you know, cherry, you know, cake with a cherry on top promises that I've heard coming out of Labour today, I could buy my own rail franchise. You know, the amount of time I have heard this, and yet I go to one of those ticket offices and I'm given a whole set of impenetrable choices, which I know for a fact aren't the cheapest ones on offer. That's the reality of rail travel right now. So, you know, it falls into that gargantuan category of, in 5 years' time, if we have all of these wonderful things that, you know, Labour are promising us in terms of what it means from the consumer arm of taking rail back into national ownership, then I will rename myself Lala Moonchild and go and live in a yurt. I can guarantee you that whether they're privatised or whether they're nationalised, we're all going to be standing there going, what's this fare and is this the cheapest and why is this one 20 quid if I buy this one but 30 quid, you know, we'll all still be doing it because that's just how our rail rolls.
I just have to question that because if a plane takes off to Rwanda with asylum seekers on board, you will in fact already be called Lala Moonchild and be living in a yurt. So
that is true. But I am so certain that a plane is not going to take off to Rwanda with a boatload of people on it that I'm still prepared to make that pledge to.
Okay, well, noted.
Because again, we'll all believe it when we see it. So, all right, if I am wrong and I'm already called Lala Moonchild, then I will call myself Lala Moonchild the Third, and buy another yurt and you can come and live next to me and be
right,
my neighbour.
Deal. That sounds lovely. By the way, I heard some really interesting polling on Times Radio just on the Rwanda thing that actually the public sort of take on the Rwanda plan is not so much that they care about a plane being taking off, is they want the boats to stop crossing the English Channel. And that's where public opinion is. Actually, the plane is kind of by the by and asylum seekers actually being removed on a plane is by the by. It's about stopping the boats. Oh, which I think is fascinating.
And of course, and it was always about stopping the boats. The argument isn't that. It's the argument about, will the Rwanda plane policy actually do that? That was always the problem with it. And obviously we've seen, you know, more terrible deaths on the channel this week. You know, the reality of this is that you can play politics with it. You know, there is a perfectly rational, sensible, humanitarian reason to stop the boat, because they are run by vicious, evil, wicked people who don't care if the people that they pile onto boats live or die in the crossing. That's the reality of it. That's fine you know, it's not that I have the problem with, it's that I simply don't think that policy is a workable policy. I don't think it was ever going to work. I don't think it was worth expending that much political capital on it. And actually, what you have had is the returns agreement to Albania, which has seen a reduction in those crossings by a third. What this government should always have been pursuing are more returns agreements. That is a workable policy. Mm. Rwanda, not so much.
Well, there we are. Lala Moonchild, TBC. But Kirsty, thank you very much. And I would just like to say that we started this podcast with me saying we should rebrand it Kirsty Buchanan After Dark. I can confirm that during the course of recording this, it has in fact got dark to the point where I can't really see Kirsty anymore. So there we are. I think it's probably time for everyone to stop for the day and to go to bed.
Time for bed. Nighty-night.
Thank you very much, Kirsty Buchanan. You're a legend. If you'd like to find out more about Kirsty's time in office, then go and buy Tim Shipman's new book, because apparently she's in there.
Oh, God.
Who knows in what capacity or saying what, but she's there. So you can go and read that.
Something wise, I hope.
I am certain of that. Thank you so much for listening. Of course, you can email us anytime. The email address is hello@whitehallsources.com. And we will speak to you again next week. We'll probably be slightly off schedule because of it being election day next Thursday. But fear not, we will drop into your podcast feed just when you need us. So don't worry about that. And we'll speak to you then.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.